Stories of sexual harassment are flooding the news these days from the worlds of entertainment, politics, and business, and the pattern seems to repeat itself endlessly. A powerful man uses his position to extort sex from women he sees as subject to that power and therefore constrained from speaking out. The widespread practice is out in the open now, but the behavior patterns here are deeply rooted. Are they likely to change? We're asking Professor Mita Chesney Lynn, chair of the Women's Studies Program at the University of Hawaii at Manoa, to weigh in. Is this the sea change that people have been waiting for?
Well, I think I'm certainly encouraged by what's going on, and I think one of the things that's changed is women are being believed now when they come forward. And when Mitch McConnell looked the camera in the eye and said, "I believe the women," that was a moment for me.
Yeah, that wouldn't have happened in the Anita Hill days, would
no,
it?
No. And, we could go back. Some of us were talking about going back decades ago when the news media basically turned a blind eye towards anything having to do with sexuality, mm-hmm. Well-known conduct, say, on the part of the President of the United States during the Kennedy era. Again, not saying that he was necessarily engaged in sexual harassment. The issue here is really if you're in a power relationship over individuals that you're supervising, that's sexual harassment. It's illegal. Mm-hmm. It's a form of sex discrimination. The entertainment figures that we've been hearing about, we could start, I think, with Bill Cosby as one of the reasons that there's a sea change. And this just has to do with the fact, two things, I think. One, the numbers.
Yeah.
That there were a number of women who came forward, each maybe individually in the past had, suffered some of the problems that happen when women come forward. But in the aggregate, when you have over 50 women alleging that something has happened to them at the hands of a powerful individual who has a lot more power than they did and mm-hmm. a lot more control over their careers than vice versa, things change. And I think the second thing was that the women came forward and the media covered it and covered it in a credible and thoroughgoing way journalistically. Mm-hmm. And so, it starts with Cosby and the images of the 50-plus women. And then you come to the Weinstein scandal. And again, a really courageous reporter takes that on. I think he was not successful in getting it placed in the first, I think he was working for the New York Times, but he ends up putting it in another publication. And I'm
Ronan Farrow in
The
New Yorker.
Yeah. Exactly. Mm-hmm. So he goes to the New Yorker to get the story out. So mm-hmm. I think that it's a story of courageous victims coming forward, knowing what's going to happen to them. It also is a courageous journalist who says, "We're going to cover this."
And then as soon as that story came out, people said, "Oh, yeah, I've known about this for 20, 30 years."
Yeah.
I mean, what's that about?
Well, that's the other problem here, and that is that organizations can be complicit. And I guess that's the word of the year.
Yeah.
And I think what we saw initially, I think, was people trying to say, "Oh, we had no idea." But then once people really start pushing, everybody says, "Oh, well, we knew something was going on, but, what are you going to do?" And often, because the power of the individual involved, you even kind of get these codependent relationships that they have with their organizations where when they do get in trouble. And one of the other things I think I want to stress as a criminologist is men who are sexual assailants, and most of the perpetrators in these cases, even if the men are victims, are men. Mm-hmm. They're going to do this more than once. They repeat the behavior. This is not – I think when people hear about sexual harassment, they say, "Oh, you want to ban sex." This is not about sex.
Mm-hmm.
This is really about power and control over others and an exploitative relationship that you kind of look for those opportunities and then you seize them when they come your way.
That's been the big change in our understanding of sexual crimes.
Yes.
It really seems to have come mm-hmm. about maybe in the last 20,
right,
30 years that these guys aren't after sex.
No.
They're about exercising power. The power is the thrill.
It seems like it. And if you hear some of the peculiar stories, and we're certainly not going to repeat them on this newscast, but
you can imagine them.
We've all heard about them.
Sure.
And it's puzzling, I think, to people who are you know, thinking that this is about sexuality, to hear what's actually alleged.
Right.
And that is really one of the earmarks of this, that this is, I get to do this, and you can't, you have no choice but to participate.
What's the, there's an aggressive component to a lot of the behavior where you really, the mm-hmm. the goal is not just to have some sort of sexual release, but
no.
to actually degrade the woman. Where's that aggressive?
You know,
what's that about?
I'm startling.
But we all had mothers, you know.
Right.
How did we lose that
right.
regard
well,
for
I think
the female?
Well, I think this is the conversation that we need to have, Chris. This is men starting to have a conversation about masculinity, sexuality, power, control. Mm-hmm. I think one of the differences is that we have young men like you said his name, and I've already blocked it. And again, that covered the Weinstein story.
Ronan Farrow.
You've got young men who understand that this is a problem, and mm-hmm. they're studying it. My colleague Walter DeCesaretti has covered campus sexual assault, and he says that, you know, in institutions, and he studied universities, in institutions where this happens, it's not all men. It's a small group of men who find themselves and kind of gravitate to spaces where they can do, in their case, it's, you know, planning campus sexual assaults in a very predatory way. Mm-hmm. They don't necessarily let other men in on exactly what's going on. So he calls it the male peer support model of a campus sexual assault, and it sounds like it, you know, yay for us. Mm-hmm. But it's actually a kind of creepy form of masculinity that exists in organizations. And then the organizations themselves tend to regard the issue as complicated, and historically it's been a he said, she said situation. So organizations have had no particular interest in paying attention to this. Universities and the military were some of the earliest organizations that had to look at it, because we have so many young people that mm-hmm. we're supervising mm-hmm. in both sets of organizations. So I've been at this for, I don't want to say how many decades, trying to say, you know, we got a lot of vulnerable people who come to us, you know, the parents turn them over to us and expect us to do a good job of educating their kids. And they certainly don't expect to have their daughters targeted by, you know, faculty whom they're going to get educated, you know, receive an education.
Well, let me posit something to you, Mita. In the recent obituaries for Hugh Hefner, he was there was a sort of, you know, admiration of this liberator of our sexual mores and things like that. Here's a guy who spent his whole life essentially exploiting women.
Yep.
How is he
20-year-old women?
How
right.
is he anything other than a pimp? And yet he was in the popular media. You know, there's this sort of, boy, you know, we got this kind of admiration.
Right.
He's a playboy. He got around. You know, there's a kind of admiration for that. That was certainly true in the way John F. Kennedy was covered.
Right.
You know, the press had a kind of a grudging admiration of him. Boy, he mm-hmm. sure, you know, mm-hmm. he could have any
a
woman he
man.
Wanted to.
Yeah.
Ladies
right.
man, right.
Yeah.
That was an admired thing in American culture. Still
exactly.
is.
I think that,
and yet
yeah.
we're talking about a predator, a pimp. You know, there are some not very attractive ways to characterize that exact same behavior.
Lifestyle. Right.
right.
Well, I think, you know, whenever you have an unequal relationship, the issue of consent is always a question mark. And in Hefner's case, you know, he obviously had an enormous amount of power in terms of the media.
Sure.
And, I get it that some of these figures, and they're pretty large figures that we're talking about, have a mixed legacy. And I would certainly say that an open conversation about sexuality is a positive. Mm-hmm. And some would argue that Hefner, you know, broke us out of the kind of silence that we were in about sexuality. And that can be seen as a plus. But the other side of it, the dark side of it, is that this was about male sexuality and male privilege. And there was no question
Subjugation.
Yeah, in the minds of, you know, and of course then the sexualization and the objectification of women's bodies that came with Playboy is something we're still battling against. It's why when rape victims come forward, the first question is, what was she wearing?
Yeah.
Because the issue is not understanding sexual assault as assault. They understand it as, well, there was sex, so was she asking for sex?
Provocation.
Yeah, that kind of thing. So,
are we getting anywhere, you know, with these? I mean, is society getting anywhere?
Well, I think the main thing you want to do in a program like this is to, first of all, say sexual harassment is unfortunately very common in the workplace. 1 in 3 women in a recent study reported that they'd been the victims of sexual harassment. Mm-hmm. 1 in 4 individuals say that they've seen sexual harassment in their work environments. So we know we have a huge challenge as a society. What I always want to tell people is there are things you can do about this. It is, again, illegal. Mm-hmm. I don't think you can count on HR departments to necessarily be your ally in these circumstances, but you can go to both the Federal Civil Rights Commission. Again, if it's employment related, it's sex discrimination. If somebody says, I'll hire you if you go to bed with me, mm-hmm. or I'll give you a better schedule if you go to bed with me. And it's even illegal for a work environment to be what's called hostile in terms of, say, having pornographic, things pinned on lockers and stuff like that. So you can go to the Federal Civil Rights Commission. You can go to the Hawaii State Civil Rights Commission. Organizations like my own campus, we have our special EEO office that you can go to. So, I urge people who feel that they're being victimized by this, and, we've talked about universities, we've talked about entertainment, but industries that are actually haunted by this are often private. They're big banks, they're businesses. And again, our goal is to change the way we respond to this behavior because we know it's illegal and we know it's wrong.
Those large institutions have a lot at stake.
Yeah.
And they're going to bring a lot to bear on an individual accuser.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to say she misunderstood. They're going to say, well, women are emotional, all the stuff that you've heard a million times. And that's a pretty powerful way to fight back at a lone accuser, isn't it?
That's one of the problems historically is that, we cannot promise victims that everything will be in confidence. So their name is going to be out there. It's one reason a lot of people hesitate. But we're also organizationally changing our behavior. In the old days, when students would come to me and say that they were being sexually harassed by a professor, I had an option of either saying to them, I'm going to keep this confidential or, we're going to go to file a complaint. Now, especially if somebody comes to me and tells me that they're a victim of sexual assault on my campus, I have to report that to my supervisors. So even though I'm thinking, well, maybe this is in the best interest of the student not to tell anybody, those organizations are beginning to understand that we need to change the organizational culture, and we can't have all these people who sort of know that so-and-so does this but isn't doing anything about it.
Yeah.
And so that was the dark side even of some of my historic behaviors of kind of reassuring victims. I wouldn't tell them unless they wanted me to tell my organization. But again, that's how we all begin to silence the behavior we allow. We basically let the student who's the victim, shift to another campus or shift to another class, and the behavior continues.
I feel as if we're only at the beginning of addressing.
It's going to be an interesting societal voyage. I'm glad we're having this conversation, so to speak.
Me too.
Okay.
Thanks very much for coming in.
My pleasure.
Professor Mita Chesney-Lind is a criminologist who chairs the Women's Studies Program at the University of Hawaii at Manoa.
Looking for something uplifting? Look no further than the Atherton Studio, where on Saturday, December 2nd, HPR presents Big Island harpist Momi Riley. Her poetic lyrics, angelic voice, and the music of her harp will raise your spirits. Purchase your seat at hprtickets.org or call 955-8821 during business hours. Sponsored by Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership Wealth Management.
It's Giving Tuesday, and Hawaii Public Radio has set a goal of 100 new members. We've already received 24 donations. Thank you to Susan Wagner of Honolulu, James Allen of Honolulu, and Robert Harris of Kailua for helping us move closer to that mark. You can donate and become a new member online at hawaiipublicradio.org or call us at 955-8821. It is 1122, and you're tuned to The Conversation. Coming up, treating drug addiction over the long term. But first, your quiz. All this week, we've been looking into the issue of raw coffee theft on Hawaii Island. Locally grown coffee is the second most valuable commodity produced in the state of Hawaii. It has an annual value of over $48 million, comes from around 900 coffee farms across the main Hawaiian islands. Most are on the Big Island, but Maui, Oahu, Molokai, and Kauai are also home to commercial coffee farms. More than 80% of individual coffee farms are located on Hawaii Island, but it's only home to about 50% of the total acreage dedicated to coffee production. This means that other islands are home to fewer but much larger farms. Despite the big presence of coffee in Hawaii's image and economy, local coffee production only accounts for less than 0.5% of global totals. But all that caffeine doesn't come off the branch ready to drink. It has to be processed and roasted. So for today's backyard quiz, we wanted to know, where was the first ever coffee mill in Hawaii built and who owned it? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Hi, aloha. I'm Jamal Yogis, author of All Our Waves Are Water. If you like today's music, find the playlist at The Conversation on hawaiipublicradio.org.
All this week on The Conversation, we're looking into the issue of coffee theft on Hawaii Island. Yesterday, we spoke to Adria McLish, a South Kona farmer who's on the verge of going out of business after having thousands of pounds of raw coffee stolen right off her trees.
We go out there to pick coffee. The next day, it's gone. Gone. Branches on the ground, coffee on the ground, because they were out there in the middle of the night picking it. My mom just wants to give up.
To get a better sense of how serious a problem theft is for the Kona coffee industry, we called Roger Kaivi, president of the Kona Coffee Council. He's a grower and processor of coffee and told Conversation producer Ryan Finity about the economics of growing coffee and the history of coffee theft in Kona.
Pre-1980, ag theft was at a bare minimum. And if there was ag theft, it was usually a family member, usually with an alcohol or drug problem. As I told you before, those folks would leave their coffee on the side of the road and on actually Mamalohoa Highway. So we could stop virtually in the middle of the road, load up 5, 10, 50 bags at times, take that back to the mill. Of course, each bag is marked with their farm number. We'll just use 111, for instance, so we can identify them and get them paid correctly. As time progressed, of course, outside thievery started to happen more and more often. So folks kept it closer to their homes, maybe next to their garage or behind lock and key. In the late 90s, you started to have the vertically integrated farmers. So folks who, you know, small people who processed their own and sold it on the websites, and they did okay. Today's market, it's pretty competitive. There's not as many processors, but the prices are much, much higher. So in the pre-1980 prices I was telling you about, coffee cherry was about 65 to 70 cents a pound. And I would say in 1996, it reached a dollar, and I think in 1997, I think it was $1.72, which is a record high. Well, nowadays, with the advent of or the introduction of CBB, farmers, it's like $2,500 an acre additional just to farm. So
that's
if we're not
coffee
paying
berry borer beetle.
In that $2 a pound range, farmers can't make it. That was one of my first things, too, because not only am I a processor, I have 20 acres of coffee myself. I know the numbers. And if it's below $1.85, it doesn't make any sense.
So do you think the high price of coffee right now is partially driving the recent uptick in theft?
Absolutely. I mean, well, high prices and easy places to sell it. Now, you and I are, neither one of us are criminals, so we can't identify those places. But there's obviously some place that is taking this coffee. You know, as you know, with crime, nobody will steal anything if they can't sell it.
So my understanding, Roger, is that there's some legal documentation that includes, the identity of the buyer and the seller, tax information, all of that stuff that is required to be presented when there's a transfer from a producer to a processor. Is that correct?
That is correct. I don't have the HRS standard, and I actually think it went into effect about 6 or 7 years ago. But they do require a form. It's similar to an affidavit, or maybe even an affidavit. It's called a C6 form. It lists the buyer and seller's names, the commodity, the estimated pounds of commodity. And for instance, if you were my nephew or my son, it has a spot for you if you were transporting that for me. Now, that's not just for coffee. That's for any agricultural commodity, because not just coffee is being stolen every day.
What other crops are commonly stolen?
So in South Kona area, macadamia nuts, avocados. In Kau, there's a lot of oranges being stolen. And you get lychee on the Hilo side. And pineapple, of course, in Oahu. That's what I think the bill was originated for, was those other larger crops, because it's easier for somebody to steal 300 pounds of avocados in a broad daylight. 300 pounds of coffee, it would take you 8 to 12 hours if you were fast to pick it. Or avocados, you can do it in 2 hours.
So it would seem, though, that the C6 form is not really effective at preventing stolen coffee from being moved.
I disagree. I think it's effective. However, it's not enforced. So nothing can be enforced if it's not effective. You know, it was speed limits without signs and without police officers giving tickets are just speed limits.
Who's responsible for enforcing those laws?
That would be the Hawaii Department of Agriculture, as well as, that's also local police, too, because it does fall under the same jurisdiction.
So, Roger, most of the farmers in your area are pretty small. They don't have that many acres, and their profit margins are pretty small. I want to play a clip from the farmer who brought this story to our attention. Her name's Adria McClish. She owns and operates the Wild Mat Coffee Company in South Kona, and she's been experiencing a lot of theft recently, and this is what she had to say about it.
My mom just wants to give up. You know, it's not even worth going out there picking coffee. We took in 35 pounds for a day's pick. That's nothing.
What would be a normal day's pick?
At least 100 pounds.
So, Roger, is this farm pretty representative of the ones that your organization represents? And how devastating is this type of theft to farms of that size?
Well, yes, it is, first and foremost. And it's extremely devastating. You know, so she's just taken two-thirds of her living off the table with that. And my heart goes out to her. You know, I hope and pray that she's got good neighbors so that they can start a watch program so they can take care of one another.
Adria told us she has reported it to the police, and she had nothing bad to say about the police, but it just seems like there's not a whole lot they can do without some solid evidence, which is really hard to get. How common is this type of theft amongst the farms you represent?
It's fairly common, I would say, in the small farms in the rural areas. You know, maybe one out of 10 sees this once a year. But, you know, for the police officer's perspective, I mean, we've only got two or three police officers on duty at a time for South Kona, all of South Kona.
So really impractical for a spread out, mostly rural area for the police to really respond to these types of
very difficult. And again, us as taxpayers, that's where we need to stand up to our local legislators, Department of Agriculture, police, to ask our prosecutors for help and get some funding.
And the county prosecutor's office does have someone whose sole responsibility is agriculture theft. Have you had any kind of interactions with that office?
I helped Mitch kind of start that process. His office started the process. I weighed in with my information, my two cents. Mitch has always been a good friend of the coffee farmers, and I think once we can get this person or persons that have started this job, get their feet wet and letting them learn the industry, I think it'll be extremely helpful.
So reason to be optimistic if you're a farmer experiencing some problems.
Absolutely. So in the past, for instance, and this happened often, we'd get a phone call from the police department. Hi, this is Officer so-and-so. There was a brown truck, Toyota truck, left scene, South Kona, about an hour ago with three bags of stolen coffee. Could you be, you know, that kind of thing. And it was easy. People showed up. One of us slipped away. We called the police while the other one kept them busy, maybe filling out a form, and they got arrested. I wish it was every time, but one out of whatever is better than none, right?
All right. Roger Kaivi, thank you so much for your time today.
You bet.
Roger Kaivi is president of the Kona Coffee Council and a small coffee farmer himself. Tomorrow on The Conversation, we'll be speaking with Hawaii County Prosecuting Attorney Mitch Roth and Shane Muramaru, the county's agriculture crimes investigator. They'll tell us about their strategy of deterrence to prevent agriculture theft on Hawaii Island.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii, whose Kidney Cars program provides funding for community health and education services. Learn more about vehicle donation at kidneyhi.org.
Hi, this is Dabney Goff of HPR's New Generation Listen. If you're a younger listener of this station, join us tonight at 5:30 at Aloha Beer Company for a behind-the-scenes tour of the brewery and a chance to hang out with like-minded HPR lovers. We'll also be picking an HPR Gen Listen beer, and since it's Giving Tuesday, proceeds from the sales of this beer in December will go to our favorite public radio station. Space is limited, so reserve your spot now at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Habilitat, the drug rehabilitation facility on Oahu's windward side, comes to most people's attention this time of year through its Christmas tree sale. But for Jeff Nash, Habilitat's executive director, it's a year-round mission, one whose methods are built as an alternative to traditional 12-step programs. Habilitat's method takes addicts through three stages: treatment, reentry, and post-reentry. And Jeff is with us to say why all three stages are essential to long-term success. Hi, Jeff. Thanks for coming in.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
To some degree, is Habilitat kind of a rethinking of methods of addiction treatment?
Well, it's certainly a different approach than the mainstream approach.
Mm-hmm. What's different about it?
Well, there's several things that are different. We take a behavioral approach, so it's not a hospital setting. It's not a medical model. Mm-hmm. And, of course, it's long-term. A typical stay at Habilitat is about 28 months long to go through all the different processes.
Wow.
And, of course, we take a holistic approach. We're not giving people psychotropic medicines. It's basically a recovery community, in mm-hmm. a sense.
What's a psychotropic medicine?
That would be medicines that are prescribed by a psychiatrist. antidepressants, antipsychotics, and
Zoloft.
Zoloft, yeah. So there's been a trend in the addiction treatment industry to prescribe these medicines, especially in a crisis situation, as, mm-hmm. as a crisis intervention. And, you know, that's certainly one way to do it. Our approach is a little bit more holistic. We want to teach people how to make good decisions, how to eat properly, exercise, how to have healthy boundaries. It's a very holistic approach.
How define holistic for me, if you will, sort of all aspects of
all
behavior?
All aspects of behavior, attitude, decision-making. Yeah, the whole aspect of mm-hmm. the whole human being. So our approach is actually not just about addiction. We're looking to treat the entire person and their particular circumstance. So, you know, for us, the drug use is just a symptom of a great many other problems. So from our perspective, if you just get the person to abstain from drugs and alcohol, you haven't really fixed the problem. And as such, you see a lot of relapse. So drug use is really not our focus. It's to heal and learn how to deal with all the things that created the addiction to begin with.
When somebody first comes into your facility, mm-hmm. they're probably, in terms of the behavior you want to change, they're probably at the beginning of their stay doing everything wrong.
Well, I don't know that they're doing everything wrong, but there's certainly more resourceful ways to do things, and that's what we're going to teach them. So, yeah, you see a lot.
But you know what I mean. They're locked into behaviors that are counterproductive.
Yeah, and usually they're coping skills, and they're not resourceful coping skills. So they can, and they learn. They weren't born that way. They learn these coping skills through their experience in life. And if they learn those skills, then certainly they can be taught other skills, and that's what we concentrate on. But, yes, you're correct.
Addicts can be extremely resourceful and clever in getting to their goal of getting high, right?
You are exactly right. And what we found in the 46 years that we've been doing this is uh-huh. that if we can capture and refocus that type of energy, ex-addicts can be a real force to be reckoned with, you know, in a positive way.
Because, you know, the classic sort of paradigm of the manipulative addict, the hustler, is based on a pretty sophisticated understanding of human behavior, right?
Correct.
This
yeah.
is you do what you've got to do to get to what you want, which is to get high.
Right.
And that can, you know, that can really draw on, it can bring out a lot of, you know, it can be very intelligently done.
It can be. And if the end goal is something a little more positive, something that benefits your family or your community or whatever, those inherent skills that every drug addict comes with, it can be a very powerful thing. You know, a lot of times people don't believe it, but I'm a former drug addict from mm-hmm. many years ago. And that's what I learned that ability that was to focus that same energy that I used to cop dope every day, to get over on everybody, to beat the system, but to use it in an honest way to help people.
One of the things that's almost an inevitable part of an addict's life is causing pain to those you love the most in the world, right?
That is correct, and that's one of the things that we teach people not to do.
How do you deal with that? I mean, you would think that we would have an instinctive aversion to that, but dope seems to just wipe out that aversion.
Yeah, so people that become severely addicted to drugs, it becomes a very selfish thing, and they get really lost in continuing their addiction, and what happens is the addiction becomes the only thing that's important. And family members, even we've seen cases with they forsake their children, they
sure.
give up their children, and then of course when they get off of the drugs and they start to put their lives back together, there's a lot of guilt that has to be dealt with because mm-hmm. of the poor decisions they made. But yeah, there's a lot of people that get hurt because of it, and people that are in the throes of their addiction, they really can't see past the next hit. And for people who've never been in that situation, seriously addicted or whatever, they just can't understand it. And it is difficult to understand.
Once you get on the road to recovery to the point where your conscience kicks in and you're feeling guilt over the people you've hurt, that can be a paralyzing thing.
Yes, it can.
How do you get past that? I mean, I would think that would be cause a lot of relapses, you know, the difficulty of getting past that particular hurdle.
Sure. So for a lot of us, it means trying to right the wrongs. In my particular case, the most important thing my family wanted to see is that I was living a decent, honorable life. So choosing that path and finding meaningful work that helps other people to make our community better reconciled a lot of the things that that had happened between me and my family. So we teach people to correct, you know, to make amends, you know, to make amends for the things that they did wrong. And in some cases, that means just stop harming people and start doing the right thing, you know, by your family, by your community.
When you've got someone at the facility who has done that kind of harm and is racked with guilt, how do you reach somebody like that? You would think they would be so caught up in the, you know, in their own problems. How do you even get through?
Well, you create a safe environment, and you create an environment where they can talk about it. So it's interesting because our society is actually it actually frowns upon people, especially men in our society, talking about the way they feel. We're supposed to just, you know.
Weakness.
Yeah, it's weakness or whatever.
Yeah.
And the reality is if you want to heal, you've got to start to discuss it, and you've got to confide in some other people that maybe have been there and done that and can help you find your way out. So the first step is to create some dialogue and get, you know, we have to create a bond with the individual so that they trust us and they believe in us. And then slowly but surely, we start to talk about it and find out what they feel, and look at the, you know, various ways that we can assist them to make right those things that they've done wrong.
Doesn't sound like something that could be done in 30 days, does it?
No. It takes a long time. Yeah.
Well, Jeff, we wish you luck.
Well, thank you.
Good work that you're doing.
Well, we certainly appreciate it, and good luck to you too.
Thanks for coming in. Jeff Nash is Executive Director of Habilitat, and you can find a link to the center's Christmas tree program on the conversation page at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Aloha, I'm Kupa'a from Kailua, and you're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we took a look back at the history of coffee production in Hawaii. Hawaii's earliest coffee trees came by way of Brazil aboard the HMS Blonde in 1825. They were planted in Oahu's Manoa Valley by gardener John Wilkinson, but they didn't do well. Several other locations around Honolulu were tried without luck before missionaries in Hilo reported success in using cuttings to grow new trees on Hawaii Island. That was around 1828. In that same year, coffee came to the now-famous Kona region when Reverend Samuel Ruggles was transferred to the Kealakekua Church, and the rest is history. It makes sense, then, that Hawaii's first coffee mill was built near Kealakekua Bay in 1880 by John Gaspar Sr. Nobody got that today. There are no winners, but there will be tomorrow. So that's today's quiz. If you've got one, you can send it to TalkBack at hawaiipublicradio.org. If you want to learn about Hawaii families, listen to the children. That's what Lee Cataluna did for her 2016 book, Ordinary Ohana. In the simple language of kids, it tells stories of cousins, aunties, and Hanai siblings, family gatherings, school fundraisers, and high school graduations, all the ways that we define ohana in Hawaii. The stories inspired her to craft a play for the Honolulu Theater for Youth, Ordinary Stories from an Ordinary Ohana. She's with us in our studio. Good morning, Lee.
Thank you so much for having me here, Chris.
My pleasure. You know, this. I was looking at your book, Ordinary Ohana, today, and there's a kind of a purity to the language that kids use, because it's a simple vocabulary that says a lot. Is that the way it seemed to you when you put that book together?
Sort of. One of the things I did do was, you know, this is it's a first person narrator and it's a kid, mm-hmm. but he is kind of a well spoken kid, you know, and I think kids today do have a grasp of the language that's fairly sophisticated.
It can surprise you.
Yeah, so you know it is simple, but he you know he doesn't falter.
But it never reads to me, Lee, like an adult writing in. As a kid.
Thanks, I think, said the professional writer.
So as I said that, I thought, I'm not sure that came out right.
Why did I go to grad school for this?
But, you know, as a writer, when things sound and feel too written,
right.
It's a bridge too far.
Yes,
yeah?
and nobody really enjoys reading that. So, yes, thank you, I guess. Sure.
Well, no, it was definitely intended as praise.
Okay.
But, you know, I have an Auntie Angie who isn't an auntie. She's mm-hmm. my mom's partner and my second mom. And there's lots of, in this particular book, and I'm figuring in the play, there are stories of families that are made aside from the traditional mom, dad, buddy, and sis outline.
That is the truth of 2017. Yeah. You know, you go into almost any classroom, and if you ask kids, you know, draw a picture of your family, you wouldn't get... The stick figure of, you know, mom, dad, yeah. you know, 1.5 kids, whatever.
Right.
You might, but there would be variations on that. And I think at this point in time, we're past the idea that that's not normal,
mm-hmm.
that's somehow exceptional. That's ordinary. You know, people being raised by just a mom or just a dad or two dads or two moms or yeah. grandma or auntie or my foster mom or mm-hmm. or whatever.
That's a fairly recent shift, though, in society, isn't it?
Is it?
Well, I mean, maybe I'm just being old, but, you know, when I was a kid, we watched Ozzie and Harriet and the Donna Reed Show, and they gave us this picture of the American family behind the white picket fence, you know, mom, dad, buddy, and sis.
Right.
And that was a family. And if you didn't fit into that niche, you might not, you know.
And then how did you feel if you didn't fit into that niche? I mean, you yourself didn't fit into that.
I didn't fit into that niche yeah. as a kid. And, yeah, I knew I wasn't in an Ozzie and Harriet home. Let's put it that way, right?
You turned out okay.
Well, let's hope so. But the whole idea of, I think if you go back to that generation, there was a certain pressure to be in a family that obeyed a traditional form and feeling that something was a little strange if you didn't.
And if you didn't, to have to explain
yes.
why. And
that's right.
I wanted to have a child narrator, a first-person child narrator, mm-hmm. Just introduce his family without explaining.
Yeah.
Because that's his ordinary, and he's very happy. And... So to take the book and turn it into a play,
yeah.
You know, to bring action and drama and fun and movement to that, it's these stories kind of come to life
mm-hmm.
Where you realize this child's ordinary ohana is actually not ordinary at all, although it may reflect, you know, your family or your neighbor's family or whatever. But it's very loving. You know,
mm-hmm.
it's very loving. And the power is with the child to say, this is my family. This is who loves me and who I love. And that's what makes it ordinary.
You know, I always felt, Lee, in coming to Hawaii a long time ago, that I was coming to a place where the non-traditional family was better understood than other places that I had lived. I don't know if that's true across the board or just an individual experience, but it has always seemed to me that, you know, just the fact that you're talking about ohana, not using the English word family, but ohana, it's something a little bit different right away. You know that that's going to be something different than the...
Yeah, I think ohana is a really inclusive idea
yeah.
that goes beyond blood relation. Mm-hmm. You know, it's people that you've called auntie your whole life. And then sometimes you forget, oh, wait, we're not actually related. That's just mm-hmm. my mom's friend from high school. But, you know, for all intents and purposes, she's family, you know, and I love her like family, that kind of stuff.
A Hanai mm-hmm. child is a child.
Absolutely.
And I think that's, and maybe that's what I find different about Hawaii society, that the very robust understanding of what Hanai means.
Mm-hmm. My father had a Hanai sister, and she kind of appears both in the book and in the play, although I don't think she would recognize herself. I've changed. I've taken liberties. But his Hanai sister was taken back to her original mother when she was in her teens because she became helpful around the house at that point. But my father always knew her as his tita.
Mm-hmm.
And then she was actually his cousin. So he calls her cousin tita. And then for us, because it's my dad's cousin tita, she's auntie cousin tita.
Mm-hmm.
So for the next generation, she would be grandma auntie cousin tita. So grandma auntie cousin tita appears in the play. She's one of my favorite characters.
Yeah.
Loosely tied to my own auntie cousin tita.
But that just the fact of that designation, you know, you have to have four names
right.
for it.
Yes. And she says, and you may call me grandma auntie cousin tita.
It sounds as if you're sort of moving toward the notion that what is it that knits an ohana together other than blood?
Yeah.
It sounds as if love is what?
Love and support love and understanding and acceptance.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, that's a big part of it. And how they are together. I think that's a really important thing for a child to say. You know, I've taught writing. I've mm-hmm. taught creative writing. And I always say it this way. I've taught creative writing in high school, and I've taught creative writing in a maximum security prison. And the prison was easier. But that's another story.
I'm not entirely surprised to hear that. Yeah, you know.
But the stories that I would read from my students about their family, they were amazing because they were just saying, this is who we are together.
Yeah.
And each child or each student, you know, today's kids are amazing. They felt so empowered to just lay it out there. This is who we are together. And I think when people start to hear family stories, it makes them kind of dig around in their own family stories and remember things that maybe they had forgotten or see things in a different light. And so, yeah, that's what I'm sort of hoping that happens as people leave the theater in their car going home, that they start going, you know, that uncle, that reminds me of our Uncle Ed. You remember Uncle Ed?
Uh-huh,
oh, yeah,
uh-huh.
I remember Uncle Ed. And, you know, and the stories start to flow.
That's the beauty of family stories, Lee.
Yep.
Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you so much.
Lee Cataluna is the author of Ordinary Stories from an Ordinary Ohana, a Honolulu Theater for Youth production that runs Saturdays until December 16th at the Tenney Theater in downtown Honolulu.
I'm Stephen Dubner. On the next Freakonomics Radio, what do you call someone trying to live his life strictly according to the rules of economics?
I call them econs for short.
And you'll hear what New Yorkers think of this mythical creature.
I'm tired. I came from work. Go away. Some random jerk.
That's next time on Freakonomics Radio.
This evening at 7, right after Counterspin.
There are a lot of different activities going on throughout the state, and Morning Edition host Derek Malama joins us for a look at events going on in our community that might be a little under the radar. Good morning, Derek.
Good morning, Chris.
Well, you can learn the basics of hip-hop dancing, which who knew there was such a thing? But that frequently comes up.
Yeah, I was thinking, you know, 25 years ago, I might have been interested in this workshop, but it's too late for me.
Well, it's too late for a lot of us, but not for everyone. Derek.
No. Amira Sackett founded the all-female American Muslim trio, Where Muslim Don't Panic. Noi Tanigawa did a story on her on today's Morning Edition. You may have heard it. She'll teach dance styles like top rock, breaking, popping, and more. So dress comfortably and bring appropriate footwear. Street-worn shoes may not be worn in the dance studio. This is free and open to the public. Space is available on a first-come, first-served basis. It's in the UH Manoa Dance Building from 12:30 to 1:50 p.m. tomorrow.
And watch those shoes, right?
Yes, watch the shoes.
And a new play premieres tomorrow at UH Manoa.
The play Fa'a Lave Lave continues the journey of Mele, a Samoan Filipino lesbian. This character was introduced to Honolulu audiences at Kumu Kahua Theater earlier this year. And in this play, the death of one of Mele's family members opens doors to the past, revealing long-kept secrets. Fa'a Lave Lave premieres tomorrow at 7:30 in the Earl Ernst Lab Theater at UH Manoa.
And we had the author on the show a couple weeks ago. It really sounds like an interesting play.
Yeah, yes.
And a local author is going to lecture on food tomorrow in West Hawaii.
Dr. Renee DeFault has a new book called Unsafe at Any Meal. That's a play on the Ralph Nader book.
Yeah,
Unsafe at Any Speed. It explains food labeling in plain terms and offers guidelines for a nutritionally balanced diet. It's at 5:30 in the Keala Kikua Library tomorrow. And it's free.
Unsafe at Any Meal. It's a little scary, isn't it?
I know it is.
We'll just have to soldier on. Thanks a lot.
Yes, you're welcome.
Derek Malama joins the conversation to take a closer look at events in our community going on under the radar. And you can always find out more on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org. Today's Giving Tuesday, and Hawaii Public Radio has set a goal of 100 new members. We'd like to thank Judy Pavey of Honolulu, Christina Fisher of Honolulu, and Elizabeth Ismail of Honolulu for joining our growing family of station members. Become a new member by donating through our mobile app or by calling us at 955-8821. That's it for today's show, and up tomorrow, Hawaii Appleseed founder and co-director Victor Geminiani looks at the federal tax plan and implications for Hawaii. We'd like to hear from you. You can call our talkback line at 808-792-8217. Email is talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. Post comments on Facebook at The Conversation. Tweet us at HI Conversation. And if you missed any of this show or want a past one, find them on The Conversation page. Links to more information about guests and topics. Just look under Talk Shows for The Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Chris Vandercook. Join us tomorrow.